Now on News Talk, as part of our winter season of documentary on News Talk, producer JJ O'Shea travels to Boston to chart the development of music in this most Irish of American cities in Clear the Floor, the story of Irish music in Boston.
Music from the final session in a venue called the Littlest Bar, situated in Broad Street, right in the heart of Boston City. This wonderfully intimate space has been hosting Irish music sessions for years, and it's about to close forever. The old brick building's going to be knocked to make way for concrete condominiums, and Boston's about to lose one more unique aspect of its character. But of course, the music will survive and continue to be played in other venues throughout this most Irish of American cities. Places like the Greenbrier, the Skellig and the Somerville, where these days the music's not only played by the Irish and their descendants, but by people from all corners of the globe. But to explore the story of Irish music in Boston, we have to go back to the beginning. Back to when the Irish began arriving here in the years immediately following the famine. Poor, unskilled, and Catholic, they found themselves at the very bottom of the social ladder.
The Irish arrived in Boston to find great racism here.
Musician and author Susan Gadutis.
It was a primarily English-based community, though it was American and had been for many generations. But the Irish were still really feared and hated because of the Catholicism that they brought with them. And so the Irish came, and when they first started emigrating here, primarily in the 1850s and onward, they were really met with some suspicion. There's stories of riots on the docks when the Irish Papists arrived.
The earliest Irish immigrants came to Boston before the other ethnic minorities, before the Jewish communities, the Italians and the Eastern Europeans, and before an African-American community was established this far north. And to begin, the Irish based themselves near the docks, not far from their point of arrival.
The Irish who arrived, essentially during the famine years and afterward, arrived and had to live in really deplorable conditions. A lot of them were sort of basement apartments in low-lying waterfront areas, musty, dark, small spaces where lots of people were crammed in and living together. And then eventually they started to move away from the waterfront in Boston to communities like Roxbury, which in the late 1800s was really just a peninsula. A very marshy peninsula that was later filled in and made into the area it is now.
And as we'll see, Roxbury later provided more than just a home for the Irish. It became the centre of a vibrant social scene for the waves of immigrants after the Second World War. But in the mid-1800s, as Roxbury was being established, things were very different, and the Irish were struggling against discrimination in their efforts to find work. And of course, songs were written that reflected this reality.
Well, take a song, for instance, like No Irish Need Apply.
Singer, musician and musicologist Mick Maloney.
It was most probably written by a man called John Poole. And he wrote songs that would appeal to a general audience. If you're a songwriter, that's what you need to do if you're in popular music. And he saw that the Irish were actively discriminated against as a newly arrived ethnic group, unskilled, maybe speaking English imperfectly, and trying to establish a foothold in American society, and at the expense, of course, of other people. And it tested everything that America stood for, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, equality, and so on. And America was very confused for a few decades, a lot of resistance to the Irish. And John Poole, capturing that mood, wrote this song, No Irish Need Apply, which in a way created its own reality, basically job discrimination against the Irish. There were actually no posters have ever been found that said No Irish Need Apply, but a lot of newspaper ads, a lot of newspaper citations. And the song was sung by America's most popular singer at the time, a man called Tony Pastor, the man who invented vaudeville. And Tony Pastor, who was basically a Spanish-American, he had to sing it pretty much every night because most of his audience was Irish, his English-speaking audience. And this song became hugely popular, reflected a kind of a defiant stance of the Irish against this discrimination, and became part of the whole popular lore of America. Well, I am a decent Irishman, just come from Ballyfad. Oh, I want a situation and I want it mighty bad. A position I saw advertised, 'tis a thing for me, says I. But the dirty spalpeen ended with, no Irish need apply. Oh, says I, but that's an insult, but to get this place I'll try. So I went to see the blackguard with, no Irish need apply. Well, some may think it a misfortune to be christened Pat or Dan, but to me it is an honour to be born an Irish man. Well, I started out to find this chap, and I found him mighty soon. He was seated in the corner, he was reading the Tribune. When I told him what I came for, he in a rage did fly, and he says, you are a paddy, and no Irish need apply. Then I felt me down the rise, and that I'd like to black his eye, to tell a decent gentleman, no Irish need apply. Well, some may think it a misfortune to be christened Pat or Dan, but to me it is an honour to be born an Irish man.
Things really began to change for the Irish when they took control of local politics. They were able to work the system to their advantage.
The fact that the Irish had been ghettoised into primarily Irish neighbourhoods actually ended up inadvertently helping them to rise up in political power. Boston's political system was ward-based, in which local councilmen, or what they would call ward bosses, were elected from individual communities. So if the Irish lived in primarily Irish communities in an Irish ward, the person they elected as their representative to city council would have been an Irishman. And so as the Irish spread and began to sort of take over many communities in Boston, you started to see the rise of many Irish politicians.
But it wasn't only the rising politicians who were improving the status of the Irish. Music and song also played a role, as a new image of the Irish was emerging in the theatres and music halls, an image being created by Irish theatrical producers, and one that both presented a positive picture to the public at large and helped instill a sense of pride and identity in the Irish community. Dion Boucicault was one of the very first of these producers.
Well, people like Boucicault really created a very positive image of the Irish on the American stage. He was a playwright from Dublin. He arrived here and was very, very successful. First as a theatre manager. He's considered the father of American theatre because he invented the whole notion of touring companies, fireproof sets, and was the real progenitor of the whole idea of copyright law. And he wrote plays like the Colleen Bawn, plays like the Chacron, plays like the Poor of New York, the Octoroon, which really were almost high art. They straddled really that space between popular theatre and what was called then legitimate theatre, Shakespeare and so on. Very highly respected, a very urbane man. Melodrama was his forte, but in the melodramas, the Irish were very, very positively viewed, and they were usually the heroes of the melodrama, whereas in English creations, like Ben Jonson's The Mask, the Irish would be the buffoon.
Boucicault would typically include a traditional song in his productions, like The Wearing of the Green, to which he then added some of his own words. In fact, he played no small part in reinforcing the notion of The Wearing of the Green as an emblem of Irish identity, which is the reason why so many American tourists, even still today, feel obliged to arrive in Ireland dressed from head to toe in green. But in the late 19th century, it was a duo who were perhaps the greatest purveyors of the Irish on the American stage.
The most famous people involved in presenting Irishness on the American stage in the years after the Civil War were undoubtedly Ned Harrigan and Tony Hart. Ned Harrigan was born in New York City. His grandfather was from County Cork. He was a fisherman up in Newfoundland, part of the cod fishery migration. Tony Hart, his real name was Anthony Cannon, and his people were from Clare Island in County Mayo. They were post-famine immigrants. The two of them got together, and Harrigan and Hart became the most famous people on the American stage, dwarfing people like Gilbert and Sullivan, who came maybe a decade after they achieved prominence. David Brame was a person that that Ned Harrigan collaborated with. Ned Harrigan was born the year before the Irish famine, and he met David Brame, eventually married his daughter, who was one of the great writers of music in the concerti style, I suppose. He would be known as the Offenbach of America, director of a pit orchestra here called in the place called the Theatre Comique. Harrigan and Hart wrote literally hundreds of songs, or Harrigan and Brame, should I say, performed then by Harrigan and Hart. And about a third of them were on the Irish Experience in New York, and they were viewed in a very positive light. Yes, they might have a drink too much, they might brawl a little bit now and again, but they were basically hardworking, they were neighbourly, they were jovial, and they were very patriotic about being Americans, but also with the great pride in being Irish. And I'd say in the 30 years of Harrigan's dominance of the New York stage, he created the most positive image imaginable of the Irish in America.
I'm located at headquarters, a special officer, Cornelius Moriarty, here at your service, sir. I know the thieves and the blackguards too, wherever they may be. And if you want a fly copper, then call Moriarty. I'm a stalwart copper in the Broadway squad, a Metropolitan MP. And the youngers cry when I'm passing by, are you there, Moriarty?
Are you there, Moriarty? A song first performed and made famous by Harrigan and Hart.
The shop girls on their way to work in the morning at 8 o'clock. They wink and blink their loving eyes at me on every block.
One of the great figures in Boston's music and cultural scene around this time was a guy named Dan A. Sullivan.
Dan Neely has made a particular study of this period in Irish-American music.
Sullivan was born in West Cork in 1840, and he landed into Boston around 1874. He was an extremely active musician. He worked professionally in variety theater orchestras. He played for Irish dances all the time. He was a music teacher, and he also seems to have been involved with Boston's Gaelic League to some extent. In every facet of his life, really, he communicated the value of Irish culture to the Irish and their descendants in Boston, and he showed how music and also dance were important facets of that heritage.
Many of Dan A. Sullivan's pupils went on to success in the Boston Irish scene, and even beyond in the wider American arena. One of the most significant was Sean O'Nolan, a piper and a composer originally from County Wicklow, who came to America in 1898.
Sean O'Nolan was one of the major entertainers for the Irish community in Boston from 1910 up until he left Boston in 1930 to move to New York. He was an entertainer. He sang, he told jokes, he told stories, he played the Uilleann pipes, and was one of these people who the Irish community really looked to provide commentary. Even in the late 20s, he even started showing films to show people in Boston what Ireland looked like if they perhaps hadn't been born there, had never been, or hadn't been for a long time. He was also a composer of songs, and very important composer of songs. Many of the songs that he wrote have shown up and have endured in the tradition.
And many of Sean O'Nolan's songs reflected the new status of the Irish as they began to establish themselves.
There are certain songs in popular music that reflect a social reality. Just like Harrigan and Hart wouldn't have been successful had they not presented back to the Irish an accurate image of where they stood in American society and their popular melodramas. So popular song would not be maybe as popular as it could be if the images weren't accurate. And this is a verse of a song called The Kellys, written by Sean O'Nolan. It was made famous by the McNulty family, but there's one lovely verse. I travelled up to Boston, that city of great fame. I'd heard the Kellys living there had made themselves a name. Well, the Kellys run the State House, the Kellys run the banks. The police and fire department, sure, the Kellys fill the ranks. Dan Kelly runs the railroads, John Kelly runs the seas. Kate Kelly runs the suffragettes. and she looks right good to me.
Fortunately, Shauna Nolan recorded extensively, so we can hear him today, albeit with the hisses and crackles that were part of the listening experience on the old 78 RPM discs. I particularly like his version of My Uncle Dan McCann. I can almost see him in grease paint under the lights on the vaudeville stage.
I lately landed over here to look for me Uncle Dan. He left the county Galway about the year 61. Where he went to, I don't know. I've searched this country high and low. But back to Galway I can't go without me Uncle Dan. Have you seen me Uncle Dan McCann, a typical bit of a Galway man, landed in the USA in the year of 61. If any of thou neighbours living here has seen or heard of him anywhere, you'll oblige me if you'll help to find me Uncle Dan McCann. Me uncle was a mighty man in Ayrton's Isle the Say. He swam the river Liffey twice a day. He ran to round the Phoenix Park, could sing and dance just like a lad. He wasn't afraid to go home in the dark, my uncle Dan McCann. Have you seen me Uncle Dan McCann, a typical bit of a Galway man, landed in the USA in the year of 61. If any thou neighbours living here has seen or heard of him anywhere, you'll oblige me if you'll help to find me Uncle Dan McCann. Ha-ha, I found me Uncle Dan McCann, a very prosperous Yankee man. He's got a seat in Congress and he's leader of his clan. He helps to make America's laws, his heart and soul in Ireland's cause. God help the man that opens his jaws to me Uncle Dan McCann. So meet me Uncle Dan McCann, a typical bit of a Galway man. He fought all through the Civil War way back in 61. He was supple and limber in every joint, wasn't afraid of the bayonet point, because he belonged to the fighting ninth, my Uncle Dan McCann.
Uncle Dan McCann, typical bit of a Galway man. He could sing and dance just like a lark, and he wasn't afraid to go home in the dark. A song full of self-deprecating humour that nonetheless celebrates the achievements of the Irish in the New World.
The fortunes of the Boston Irish were changing at the end of the 19th century. So whereas they were sort of down on the social ladder and disenfranchised politically, say, after the Civil War, by the 1890s, that was beginning to change. And then in the first decade of the 20th century, that really started to change very aggressively. You know, there was newspapers in Boston that were very Irish specific. You had an Irish mayor, actually a couple of Irish mayors. You had, you know, so you had Irish families that were really beginning to rise up the social ladder in a way that they never had before.
Another pupil of Dan A. Sullivan was his son, Dan J. Sullivan. He was a piano player and composer, and he also came through the Variety Theatre, playing in his father's band. But his seems to have been a precocious talent.
In 1902, he had a hit on his hands called You're As Welcome As the Flowers in May, which is cited in Ulysses, which is kind of an interesting thing. And after that, he became much more involved in Irish themes became more a more prominent part of his output. The most important piece that he wrote in the teens was writing a song called My Irish Song of Songs with a collaborator in 1918, and it was recorded quite successfully by John McCormick that year. And so Dan J. Sullivan's star really began to rise after that.
You're a little bit heaven, you're my Irish song.
He also composed some variations on the Wearing of the Green for piano roll that still today sound vital and even contemporary. Dan Sullivan is best remembered now for the Dan Sullivan Shamrock Band, the leading Boston-based Irish dance band of the 1920s, and the very first to make a recording.
Dan Sullivan put together a band that included Mike Hanifin and a couple other fiddle players and a piper, and he brought the band down to New York in 1926. I believe it was February. Came down and he made a series of about 25 recordings that were released on the Columbia Records label that year. The advertising for these records really showed up in not only Columbia advertising for Columbia Records that they issued themselves, but in a Boston Catholic paper called The Pilot.
In fact, Dan Sullivan seems to have been a particularly astute band leader who understood the need for promotion.
One of my favorite tunes, one of my favorite records that they made was a tune called Neely's March. And it's a sort of marchy version of the polka The Siege of Venice. But what's interesting about it is it seems to have been an advertisement for a store called Neely's Music Box in South Boston. And I think it's interesting because Dan Sullivan, who came through the Variety Theater and would have known vaudeville and would have known, you know, wrote Tin Pan Alley music and would have had a very strong understanding on the importance of marketing, had the band record a tune for a store that sold his records. What's interesting about the Dan Sullivan Band is they were also on the radio kind of regularly, just performing, and I think probably to sell their records. But it wasn't just that they were performing on Boston Irish stations. The shows would be rebroadcast not only in other parts of the United States, but I found evidence that the shows would be broadcast in Australia, and I found one example of the Dan Sullivan Band being broadcast in Malaysia.
You're listening to Clear the Floor, the story of Irish music in Boston on News Talk 106 to 108.
Apart from radio broadcasts, outfits like the Shamrock Band found their audience in the new Irish dance halls that were beginning to emerge.
As the Irish community started to take hold, and they moved in and had communities like in Roxbury, you started to see the beginning of dance halls arriving because, of course, there was no television. There's no way for the community to get together on weekends other than to go to these big dance halls. That was widespread across the whole culture. Dance halls were not just among the Irish. I mean, this was a time when this was the dance hall era in general. But the Irish themselves had their own dance halls because it behooved them to really look out for each other. And to kind of take care of the new Irish that were coming. Jobs were secured. You might see someone from home. And also people would go to meet new friends and perhaps to find a spouse.
And of course, the immigrants were aware that they may never see Ireland again. So the dance halls also met an emotional need.
One of the benefits of having Irish dance halls was that you would go there and hear Irish music. So here you are, thousands of miles from home, and really in the first decades of the 20th century, returning home like people do now, once a year, once every couple of years, that was not a reality. So the homesickness factor was so extreme. And going to these dance halls, you weren't just meeting other Irish people with similar values, with similar histories, and similar needs, but you were also hearing the music of home. So it was a taste of home, and the dance halls became really important as a sort of a for a business need, but also very much for a personal need. People wanted to hear the sounds of home.
Radio broadcasts featuring Irish music made an impression on one young man who would later become one of the leading accordion players in Boston. Joe Durain seems to have been one of those lucky people who know from an early age exactly what they want to do in life.
Both my mum and dad came from Ireland. They met here and got married. And we were living in a section called Roxbury. And every Sunday there was an Irish radio program on. And one of the featured performers was this Jerry O'Brien, a wonderful button accordion player who then became my teacher. And my mother used to tell me that every Sunday they'd turn on that program and there was no interest in it for me at all until the accordion started to play. And then I would come from wherever it was in the house and I would drop whatever I was doing and stand there 5 years old, jumping up and down in front of the radio. And when the accordion stopped playing, that was it. I was off back to whatever mischief I had been into before. And that was it. But by the time I was 10, I had driven them almost frantic. And so they, you know, I wanted to learn to play this.
So Jerry O'Brien was contacted via the radio station and he became the teacher of the young Joe Durain, who had by now managed to acquire a single row button accordion. But times were getting tight. This was the era of the Depression, after all. Work was scarce again. And on the social scene, an alternative to the dance halls developed that became known as the kitchen rackets. There were house parties. Find a musician, get a barrel of beer and some sandwiches, clear the floor and invite the gang.
The kitchen rackets were very, very prevalent back in those days. Now, money was very, very tight. The economy was bad and times were tough. So when some of the Irish or Irish-American couples, whatever, they get married, there was no money to go into a hall now and get a caterer and the whole thing, you know. So what they had was a nice little private ceremony, and then they'd either have it in the apartment where they were going to live, or some an aunt or a brother or somebody said, well, you can come over and we'll have the party at my house. Okay, back in those days, all the kitchens had linoleum floors in them, as opposed to the living rooms, which had carpeting and all that stuff. So nobody wanted to rip up the carpeting. So what they would do, they would take everything out of the kitchen. So all you had in there was just the sinks and, you know, whatever stands, whatever counter space that went with them, and the refrigerator.
Now, most Irish during this time lived in a very classic Boston housing structure, which is a three-story house, three layers of apartments, which were referred to as three-deckers. And these three-deckers were built house upon house upon house through many of the immigrant neighborhoods, not just the Irish, but also the Italian communities, the Jewish communities in Roxbury, in South Boston, in East Boston. It's a very classic Boston housing style.
Joe Durain found himself playing one night at a kitchen racket in just such a three-decker. Seated on his chair in the corner, things were getting pretty wild out on the dance floor and he began to fear for his accordion. If it fell, that could be it.
It was amazing how many people were in there, inside. And when they started the dancing, that was all right. It wasn't too bad when they were just dancing waltzes or whatever. But now you get some of them, and now they wanted to dance the sets. Well, okay, but now they start with the swinging, and everything is going around, and you might have tried two sets of dancers in a 12 by 12 room. You better be very friendly. Anyway, you'd be in the corner, but they kept bumping into me, you know, and of course then I just stopped playing.
The solution he found on that occasion was to sit out on the fire escape and play in through the open kitchen window. It was cooler out there in any case. Another time, he came up with a different remedy.
It was a very crowded situation again. And I kept moving from one corner to another. And then somebody had the bright idea, well, let's take the chair out altogether. That one little lonesome chair that I'm sitting on. We'll take that out, and that'll give us a little bit more room. And he can sit on the countertop and have his feet, his legs hang over, you know. And that worked all right for just a few minutes. But when they get to, again, to the swinging, and they got into it, they were bumping into me, and, you know, I was getting banged around. But it was all right. That wasn't too bad. But, again, it was always, I'm going to drop the accordion. I'm going to, you know, whatever. So finally, I hit on, I said, all right. So I the woman of the house was there, and I said, look, this isn't going to work. I said, would it be all right with you if I'll take off my shoes and socks, and I'll put turn around sideways, and I'll put my feet in the sink? And, of course, the sound box is coming off right into the room. And she gave a roar. She said, that would be just fine. So that's the way I finished the night, playing with my feet in the sink.
Immigration was falling off during the 30s. America didn't offer the same possibilities. And this had an impact on the remaining Irish dancehalls.
There had been a lot of immigration in the 1920s, but everything slowed down during the Great Depression. And then slowed down again, of course, during World War II. And so with that, the dance halls also started to close down, or at least quiet down. Many people went back to house parties and had private gatherings, but those big, big dance hall gatherings really had faded away.
But everything changed after the Second World War. This is an era that's looked back on as a golden age. It's the era of the great dance halls in Roxbury. Five in total stretched along Dudley Street, the Hibernian, the Intercolonial, the Winslow, the Dudley Street Opera House, and the Rose Choir. Roxbury had long been a residential district for the Irish, but now Dudley Street at its centre was also a transport hub for trains and buses, so it was an easy place to get to from all parts of the city, and even from outside the city. So it's not really surprising that it became the location for a social scene that rose to meet the demands of the waves of new immigrants who were young, free, and single.
And so what started to happen was you had some young entrepreneurs now after World War II, people like Johnny Powell and his brother Mike Powell, who saw there was a new audience of dancers. There were all these young people out there, and they said, well, let's get something started again, but let's put in a new kind of band. And this is when they pulled in a new approach. They had the band, the musicians playing in tuxedos, and the new bands were very elegant and sophisticated, kind of, you know, a little Hollywood, and gave this real glamour to the dance halls. And this was enormously popular. You know, this is the 1950s, so it's a time of prosperity, a time of great optimism. And these bands sort of made all this elegance feel accessible.
As accordion player with the Johnny Powell Band, Joe Durain was a key figure.
What happened was immigration was huge after World War II. Ended in April '45. And then, say, 46 and 47, immigration was enormous. It was huge. They had wanted to come out during the war, but couldn't wait. They couldn't come. They had to wait. So you had that big influx of those. And there were a lot of different changes. But in any event, that whole thing down in Dudley Street, five ballrooms on one street within, say, maybe 300-400 yards maximum. On one street, you had the five dance halls. And it was amazing. On Saturday night, you see all the Irish coming down on the sidewalk, and the girls arm in arm. A lot of them used to wear the wide skirts, you know, with the petticoats underneath and things like that. Some did, some didn't. And it was a wonderful era. And I was just fortunate enough to be right in it, right up to my neck in it.
The dance hall bands during this period were fairly big. They might have 10 musicians. You might have two accordions, maybe two fiddles, a banjo player, a bass player, piano. You would have a drum set with a woodblock, just like the typical Cayley band. But you would also have a couple of saxophones, which was not unlike the Cayley bands that people were seeing in Ireland during the 1930s and 40s, because jazz was enormously popular there as well. The bands captured a modern feeling, but also felt traditional as well. So you might hear modern sounds, but being played on traditional instruments. Or you might hear traditional tunes being played on modern instruments. So the idea was that there was an Irishness that people felt. So there was a retention of tradition, but there was also a newness and an urban feeling. When you hear the saxophone, you can't help but think city. And so the bands were really, in some ways, serving as a little microcosm, a little bit of a model for what it felt like to be young, Irish, and urban during this time. You know, you sort of had that feeling of home. You had the longing. You had the memories of the tunes, the jigs, and the reels. But you were also living in a city. And so the electric bass and the saxophone sounds kind of helped to give that tradition a new home.
Something was happening in Boston that hadn't happened much in Ireland. Players from different counties found themselves playing together, all with their stylistic differences. So they had to find common ground. And in the process, they were creating a new Boston style.
You know, you can very much tell the difference between a Donegal fiddle player and a Kerry player and a Sligo player. Now you come to Boston and you have all these players on the same stage. Now, if you're playing next to someone who's got a different style, somebody's got to meet in the middle or the band doesn't sound so good. And so what happened was there was some degree of stylistic mashing, you know, that would happen just so that musicians could actually play in the same band together and hit the notes at the same time.
And the demand for Irish music in Boston surprised some of the musicians when they arrived.
Some of the more well-known players here in Boston, like Larry Reynolds, like Brendan Tonra, the great Sligo fiddle player, they had come from a time in Ireland, really during the 1940s, when Larry describes that he would sometimes feel like he had to hide his fiddle under his coat when he was going to lessons or coming home from school, because it was really looked at as almost backward. You know, playing the traditional tunes in some places was sort of looked upon as a little bit backward and rural. And then he came here and was very pleasantly surprised to discover that Irish music was sought after.
It's probably not going too far to suggest that during the 40s, maybe early 50s, when traditional music was being disowned by the young urbanites at home in Ireland, it was, ironically, cities like Boston and Chicago and New York that helped to keep it alive.
I think the music took on a new and elevated role when emigrants came here, in just the same way that people got over here and recognized what green grass really means. When you come over here and you live in the city and it's nothing but concrete, you start to recognize, wow, that grass really was green back at home. And so the music, I think, was another model for that same way of thinking. It was, people started to really feel very proud of their Irishness.
And of course, the first commercial recordings of Irish music were made in America. And these recordings gave the music a new frame in which it could be viewed.
At home, where you just felt like it was just, this is like the air I breathe. Nobody's necessarily valuing it. They're taking this music for granted. But when the music is recorded in a big city like New York, and someone comes home to Ireland with a record of a fiddle player, and you hear this music suddenly on a record, it suddenly makes the music, it makes it feel more important. So in many, many ways, the fact that this music was so valued by Irish emigrants in America, and they brought these recordings back, in some ways it helped to legitimize the role of music within Ireland, because people began to recognize this is actually valuable. This really matters. And maybe because of those recordings, they stopped taking it for granted so much and started seeing it as something worth preserving.
But every flower must fade, and by the early 60s, the numbers had begun to fall away from the Roxbury dance halls. There were several reasons, not least because most of the earlier generations had now married and settled down.
So first off, the success of the sort of pairing that occurred during the dance halls led to young people getting married, moving out of the city now because they have some new affluence, they're getting more settled in their jobs, they're moving a little bit further out to suburbs and having children. So the dance hall starts to lose its appeal. You can't get there anymore because you're home with the babies, right? But on top of that, you had a change in music. We have moved away now from the big band era. And now, 1956, 1957, who arrives on the scene but Elvis?
The response in Ireland to the new rock and roll sound was the show bands, whose mix of country, pop and ballads found an audience in Boston too. But what really finished the Roxbury dance halls was the complete drop in emigration numbers. De Valera had asked President Kennedy to introduce legislation to curtail the numbers entering the US from Ireland. He'd become concerned about the effects of emigration, and Kennedy complied. Without any succeeding generations, the dance halls could only fail. But the older traditional musicians weren't to be deterred. They found new venues and new ways of showcasing their music.
Key to the survival of the Boston Irish scene, and the reason it is still really a thriving scene today, is due to the musicians who did not stop playing when the dance halls closed. Musicians continued to play at private events, at Cayley's, in Cultus Kiltori, Aaron Sessions, and many, many other sessions across the city for several decades and continue to do so today.
One musician, originally from Galway, was crucial.
One of the key figures in keeping Irish music alive in Boston was Larry Reynolds, who hosted weekly sessions first at the Village Coach House and then at the Greenbrier in Boston for many, many decades. Larry and the musicians who joined him there were always very welcoming to new musicians, and those sessions would host both beginners and also visiting musicians who would come from Ireland and might be performing at some of the theaters across Boston.
One exciting development is the diversity of backgrounds in the musicians you'll find now in a typical session.
Nowadays, you can go to a session in Boston or in any of the suburbs around Boston, and you'll find a real diverse group of people playing Irish music. My husband is from Dublin, and we will often go to sessions, and he'll look around the room and say, "I'm the only Irish person here." And that's very common. And I think one of the things that was very beautiful about the Greenbrier was that people like me, a Lithuanian, with an interest in Irish music, could go there and could be welcomed.
So back now to Mike Reynolds, Tommy Sheridan, and the other players gathered for the final session at the Littlest Bar, a legendary venue for sessions in Boston, but one that sadly is about to close. Hopes for the future? Well, Susan Gadutis hopes that the commercial success of Irish music won't change one of its original features.
My hope for Irish music is that it never loses its flavor as a community-produced music and that never gets over-commercialized so that it loses that important gathering role that it has in a community.
And Joe Durain doesn't see the music disappearing anytime soon.
I am content. Content? Yeah, that's correct. I'm content that it's going to be around for a long while yet.
Clear the Floor, the story of Irish music in Boston, was written, produced, and edited by J.J. O'Shea. The programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland and the television licence fee. To listen back to this or any other News Talk documentary, go to newstalk.com/documentary on News Talk.